Bill Veeck is known to lots of fans of baseball's history as the guy who hired the 3-foot-7-inch Eddie Gaedel to hit for the St. Louis Browns once. Veeck was also the owner who brought the American League its first black player, and had he not been blocked by Commissioner Kennesaw Mountain Landis, he might have brought the major leagues their first all-black team. Paul Dixon has written Bill Veeck, Baseball's Greatest Maverick, a biography of one of the game's most inventive, entertaining, and principled figures. The author joins me now from NPR in Washington. Paul Dixon, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you, Bill.
Bill Veeck's first job in baseball was to walk around Wrigley Field and find out from Cubs fans what the team could do to make each trip to the ballpark more enjoyable. It seems to me that in some ways he never gave up that job.
He never did. You know, that was the one mark he made that was truly unique. He just put the fans first. He loved the fans. And he was, you know, I would talk to Andy McPhail, who was general manager of the Orioles, and he came from a big baseball family, father and grandfather, and he knew Veeck going up. And I said, why did the other owners hate him so much? And he said, well, the real reason, there were a lot of reasons, like he was in favor of the free agency and things like that, little small little details. He said what really drove them nuts was he loved to sit in the bleachers with the fans and take complaints.
And take his shirt off.
And smoke cigarettes and snub them out in an ashtray built into his wooden leg.
Perfect.
Yeah.
At the age of 22, Bill Veeck was in charge of renovating Wrigley Field. How did he land that kind of responsibility at 22?
He his father had been president of the Cubs, so he was in the family already. It's when his father died, he quit college, Bill did, Bill Jr., and went to work for the Cubs. And he sort of worked his way up, and in the way, he ends up meeting all these odd characters like Jack Ruby, this hustler, this ballpark hustler who later came infamously famous. But during that period, he made a lot of friends, Abe Saperstein and other people in Chicago.
The Globetrotters guy.
Right. He works his way up to the point where the Wrigley, who is the owner, tells him, we got to redo the ballpark and you're in charge. And he brings in architects and a construction company. He's worked his way up and they reconfigure the whole of Wrigley Field, including planting the ivy. That was done on Veeck's watch. And if you go to Wrigley today, and as you walk in through one of the porticos, and what you see in front of you, looking out in the outfield, that configuration of the outfield, and even the groundskeeper's cottage, which is in the left field, that's exactly the way Bill Veeck planned it.
Bill Veeck first tried to become an owner in 1942 when he attempted to buy the Philadelphia Phillies. Tell us the story of his short-lived plan for that franchise.
At that point, he actually did own a minor league team. He owned the minor league Milwaukee Brewers. Mm-hmm. But during that period, his father had actually toyed around with the idea of having black teams in each major league. And Bill, he wanted to put all the great black players, Josh Gibson and Satchel Paige and cool Papa Bell, on this team, and he would become the great box office. And there was a lot of support for this back then. Even Babe Ruth suggested at one point that it might be great to have a Negro team in either league. But what eventually happened with Bill Veeck was the powers that be decided it wasn't a good idea. They didn't want to do it at the time. And they briskly said, no, we're going to take over the team instead of you. And he was blocked in trying to do this.
Shortly after he became the owner of the Cleveland Indians in 1946, Veeck hired Larry Doby. He was the American League's first black player. Describe the relationship that developed between those two men.
Well, it was extraordinary. This was 11 weeks after Jackie Robinson had been brought up by the Brooklyn Dodgers. Doby's situation was quite different than Robinson's. Doby had been brought up in a middle class, a very affluent suburb in New Jersey. He had been a class officer. He'd been captain of the football team. He had played football against Buzz Aldrin, which is an interesting parallel because two guys were number two, Buzz Aldrin being the second guy on the moon. And Doby had never experienced race hatred. He'd experienced segregation. But it was only when he gets to the majors that he starts hearing the N-word. He starts there's an exhibition game that he plays in Houston in the Indians uniform where they throw rocks at him, where they curse him. They curse him everywhere he goes. There's real antagonism towards him. And I think he wasn't prepared for this. And I think Veeck and he had this bond. And anytime Doby got really depressed, Veeck would, you know, take him out to hear Ella Fitzgerald or go to hear a Miles Davis concert. But they had a special relationship. And Doby flowered under Veeck. I mean, Doby didn't start out that well, but boy, did he become one of the great players. And you know, and again, of course, what happened the year after he brought up Doby, he got everybody angry because he brought up Satchel Paige.
Well, that was the next guy I wanted to talk about, of course, because it was 1948. A lot of people called Paige a publicity stunt. He'd been a brilliant pitcher for a long time in the Negro Leagues, but he was 48 or thereabouts when he came to the Indians. How soon did it become apparent that Vec had hired a pitcher as well as a box office draw?
Oh, pretty much right away. I mean, a shutout in Chicago. It was real clear. It was real fast. And the what really bothered the powers that be, the Sporting News and others, was that they'd for years been saying these Negro League guys aren't up to the level of the major leaguers. They couldn't even make the majors. That was the lie. That was the lie they told each other. Well, it was all right to bring up Doby or Robinson because they were young guys. But they've been saying for years that Paige wasn't that good. And now, all of a sudden, as an old man, they bring him up and he's whipping him. He just whips him. He helps get him to the World Series that year.
I knew before reading the biography that Bill Vec had a wooden leg, of course, and that he endured lots and lots of surgeries. I hadn't realized the extent of the pain that Vec suffered most of his life. Tell us a little bit about what he had to endure just to get going every morning.
He was injured in the South Pacific. He went to the Marines, demanded to go into combat. And when he got into combat, any aircraft gun had recoiled, cut his foot badly, which got infected. And during the course of his lifetime, he withstood 16 amputations. In order to get up in the morning, he had to soak his leg for 3 hours. He was in unbelievable pain. He couldn't use the regular stainless steel prostheses after a while. He actually went to a wooden leg, almost like a pirate's wooden leg. And all during this time, this unbelievable pain, some of the infection from the leg is getting into his ears, into the rest of his body. He treats it almost like a sight gag. He builds a ashtray into his wooden leg. He would buy a maritime paint, and he would paint his leg during the course of the summer to make it look like it was getting a tan. And the most famous one, towards the end of his life, he's covering the World Series for USA Today, and he's running through the Baltimore airport, hobbling through the Baltimore airport to get to a plane, and he falls and sprawled out over the corridor, and an airline employee runs up and says, Mr. Vec, can we get you a doctor? And he said, no, it's my wooden leg. Get me a carpenter. But John Shulian was writing about it one time. He was when Vec owned the White Sox. He said, Vec thinks he invented optimism. You know, this guy was always on top. He was always a gag. Everything was always funny. But he's under unbelievable pain. And he doesn't show off, but he does do things like he does march in the Martin Luther King funeral procession on the wooden leg without crutches. But that's who Bill Vec was.
You write that toward the end of his life, Vec thought of himself as, and I'm quoting now, just another bleacher bum. Was that an affectation?
Not at all. He literally, in his final days, he spent most afternoons, until he was too ill to do it, in the bleachers at Wrigley. And he would not wear a shirt, and he would sit there and smoking cigarettes and drinking beer, and he would have a bag of pork chops or lamb chops with him, which he'd pass out to reporters. He'd talk to anybody. And when he finally died, and there was a funeral service at a church in Chicago, they're three deep in line. The mourners are three deep, and one of the reporters goes in and said, how do you know, why are you here? And he said, I know Bill Vec. I talked to him many times in the bleachers.
Paul Dixon is the author of Bill Vec, Baseball's Greatest Maverick. The book is published by Walker & Company, and the author joined me from NPR in Washington. Paul, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thanks, Bill.
Way back in town, it was a mean old game.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Tribou. Our technical director is John Ferrati. We had help this week from Paul Vitkus. Our intern is Jeremy Conlin, and our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To view our photo galleries, please visit onlyagame.org. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Only a Game Radio. Our final word this week comes from True Hoops' Henry Abbott, who correctly identifies the culprit in this week's failure to connect with Henry via Skype.
Poor Gary, you probably just blame him most of the time, huh?
Yeah, and it's not just Skype. I also blame him for Barcelona's loss to Madrid on Saturday and for certain undisclosed upsets in the 2011 Kentucky Derby. Maybe he'll make up for those next week. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thank you for listening. I'll see you next week.
Bill that put the game on the radio, made those transistors really go. Bill that planted Wrigley Ivy, Bill that knew that fun was good. Bill that the baseball man always thought of the fans.
Support comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, presenting the MacArthur Award for Creative and Effective Institutions. Winners are at macfound.org. The Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for improving education and enrichment for children both in and out of school, at wallacefoundation.org. And the Poetry Foundation, celebrating 100 years of Poetry Magazine, online at poetryfoundation.org. This is NPR.